Kurt Brown is with Bill Russell and me. I am Paula Gordon. Bill, I heard the great inhale. I didn't know where you were going with that, Bill Russell.
Well, going backwards, of course. You said something earlier about writing things down, that it has to be fresh and surprising to the writer, otherwise it's not going to be fresh and surprising to the reader. It reminds me of a guy who would have been a neighbor of yours if you'd moved to your neighborhood center, who was at NYU, James Carse, who I think the last book he wrote before he retired, I don't think he's written anything since, was called The Gospel of the Beloved Disciple. And he was
a professor of the history and philosophy of religion and did television for maybe 40 years in New York City at NYU.
And what he said was, when he finished it, he said, you really don't know what you believe mm-hmm. until you write it down. And his point was that, you know, whatever the religious tradition, that there was this tradition of gospel writing that ran for 300 years. People forget about that. That the canonical gospels were only a very small portion of what was written. And he said, and this is so central that it's important to write it down and see what you really think.
Mm-hmm. And about the Jesus character.
About your perspectives, your attitudes, your feelings, your beliefs about religion. And it seems that there's something about that writing. And in some ways, something about the articulation, even, either is the spoken word or the written word, that is crystallizing. It sets the patterns, establish what you really see and think and believe.
Yeah, I wonder when we do set things down to fix them on the page and to fix them for our culture. But it seems that just like the scientific truth that we discover and that later change somehow because of new discoveries. We were talking about how rereading something after years changes it. So the same words and the same text is not so fixed as we think, and we can, it can change because we change and as we're responding to it.
As you think your way through as a poet, you write luminous poetry. Is this sense, as you talk about the cosmology, that everything's moving? At least that's the story we tell ourselves now, and as best we know, everything is always dynamic. Everything. Yeah. Do those words swim before you as a poet? Do you have that sense of total and constant? One of the words that jumped out of me as I read The Measured Word was flux. Mm-hmm. Now, this is sort of a family joke, but this constant motion, is that not a terrific challenge for a poet in this vast movement to find the word and hold it for a moment?
Yes, it is only a moment. You're trying to fix sort of a moment in time with language, but language is so imprecise and it slips and it slides and has connotations and it has ambiguities and so forth, all of which the poet revels in. But these same kinds of things would drive a scientist crazy. That's what there's no denotation, or there's no connotation in mathematics. They're trying to get rid of all connotation, have it be all denotation, because they need to replicate their results over and over again anywhere. So imprecision, ambiguity for a scientist might not be in their work, might not be something that they. That they want to find or want to deal with, but for a poet, we're trying to do that. We're trying to make a sentence or a phrase mean more than one thing, possibly two, maybe three. Better if it's four.
That's a multidimensional game you're playing with.
Yes, absolutely.
So I have to participate to make your poem whole.
Well, it would be nice if those phrases and words reverberated in your mind as a reader, as you're reading the poem, that you would say, "Oh, it could be this, it could be that." It goes back a little bit to the hypertext that we're talking about. You could go down that path, or you could go down that path.
This is 180 out from dogma, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. No poet would ever say to you, I know some truth and I'm writing it down. They would say, this is the truth or the little revelation I found today in this poem might be different tomorrow. So as Keats said famously, he was willing to live in uncertainty. Well, this is before Heisenberg now. He said he's willing, the poet is someone who's willing to live in uncertainties.
That's quite brave.
And a lot of us are not. And a lot of people would like, they want to have a truth that they can rely on. Poets, I think, generally, poets can have some truths that they rely on. They can be religious people, they can be scientists, they can be a lot of, but I think in their work, you know, the two universes that we're dealing with here is, for a scientist, the unknown that they're looking for is outside of themselves. It's out in the universe, in the physical world. The unknown for the writer, for the poet, is inside them. It's the unconscious and the subconscious, and in the self, the unknown self. So it's the inner world, the inner universe that they're trying to go into and find the unknown in.
And yet you say it is a universe. Mm-hmm. Now, how can it be uni, as in one, if they are so different?
Well, maybe the macrocosms and the microcosms and the inners and outers somehow touch and meet somewhere. I'm sure that that's true. I'm sure that, but where is that junction? I don't know.
One of your writers talks about, I think, three levels, three stages of science. And it goes, and you mentioned Heisenberg, it seems that
Heisenberg and the uncertainty principle for which he is
known.
Which
is seriously misunderstood by an awful lot of people. But relativity and quantum mechanics added uncertainty back into the equation in radical ways. And it seems that part of what you've captured is that some of the ambiguity that scientists are feeling. We had a colleague, now deceased, Per Bach, who was a condensed matter physicist, who said, you know, we're back to the point, in order to do good science,
physics,
we have to tell stories. Mm-hmm. We simply can't do good physics. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not necessarily a commonly held view amongst physicists. But he had gotten to the point in the work he did, and was working at a fairly high level, that he said, you know, the only way to make it accessible is by stories. The mathematics alone is not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I remember when I first read about Heisenberg and the uncertainty principle, sort of cheering for our side and saying, ah, take that, science. You see, you don't know either.
Well, and it's a move away from the Newtonian universe in which most of us would like to live, where everything's pretty clockwork.
Exactly.
And you know what's happening.
Exactly.
And suddenly you're back into all of those. I mean, it's magic.
So now a great deal of research, yes, now a great deal of research since Heisenberg is not so much nature itself as how does the mind, how does the search for nature and its truth and its truths and its laws, how does that search itself affect what we're seeing? And so it comes again, now that might sound like I'm saying that in essence science is also now looking for the unknown in the self in a way.
And the thing that, one of the many things, the questions are the same, you say, and your essayists say, that the questions are the big questions, the biggest questions that both the poets and the scientists ask. The how does it work? Who am I? These.
How did we get here?
Yeah.
What are we doing here?
Well,
the meaning of meaning is a you know, fairly, engaging subject. It's been going on for a while, and we're still, you know, we keep coming back at it and coming at it. And one way of doing that is poetry. Another way of doing that is science, and there are lots of other approaches.
Did that knock you out the way it did me as you were putting this together?
Yeah, I mean, all of those things figure in some way. I mean, I don't know. I see these similarities about meaning and about searching for meaning, but...
Well, I have to say, I did not expect to find in this work and in you and in these questions the meaning of life. And I haven't confessed this to Bill. I now know the meaning of life.
Oh, you do?
I do.
It's to keep searching. Maybe.
It is to create meaning.
It's great meaning, yeah.
And I found that directly out of The Measured Word, that if one wants meaning in life, you have to create it. Well, that's a whole lot different than having somebody serve you an answer on a platter. Mm-hmm. And again, this comes back mm-hmm. to the sciences and mm-hmm. to the what you just generally call literature, the way we use words, which is, of course, our prime tool. Mm-hmm. The meaning of life is to create meaning. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or not. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The mind is the perfect organ to be doing that. It's looking at itself. It's investigating itself in a way, and what it is and how it works, consciousness.
And that could be said both of the sciences and the poetics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in fairness, Kurt Gödel would take exception to that.
Gödel would? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, well. Let's come back in a moment so you can explain what Kurt Gödel would have said. This is the Paula Gordon Show. It is our great pleasure to be with Kurt Brown. Bill Russell and I invite you to be with us when we return.